Beyond Barbarossa, Episode 45, The Third Battle of Kharkiv. Welcome to Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. I'm Scott Burry, podcasting, as usual, from the Redbeard Studio on Algonquin Anishinaabe territory, also called Ottawa, on a very blustery day. So if you hear any whooshing noises, that's why. Before I go on to the episode, I just want to remind you that you can support this podcast through Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and choose the level of support, monthly or one time only, that you're comfortable with. Patreon patrons get early access to episodes as well as patron-only bonus episodes. And now, on with the show. Last episode, The Return of Mobility, described how, after 5 months of siege in Stalingrad, movement returned to the Eastern Front as the two sides pushed each other back and forth over great distances, hundreds of kilometers, in a matter of weeks. Capitalizing on the German defeat at Stalingrad, which was really a shocker for the whole world, the Red Army launched several offenses. At the end of Operation Little Saturn, they liberated the city of Rostov-on-Don in February 1943. Then, a series of operations called the Voronezh-Kharkov Strategic Offensive Operation pushed the Germans back as much as 400 kilometers in February. This operation liberated huge swathes of territory in southwestern Russia and eastern Ukraine, including the cities of Voronezh, Kursk, Izyum, Belgorod, and Kharkiv, then called by the Russians Kharkov. Field Marshal Erich von Manstein, Commander-in-Chief of Army Group Dawn, then later renamed Army Group South, scrambled to reorganize the German forces as they did what they could to resist the Red Army's advance and form a straighter, more defensible front line. Robert Cittino, a journalist and author, described in an article called Kharkov 1943, the Wehrmacht's Last Victory, quote, "On the map, Army Group Dawn seemed to fill the hole, but reality fell far short of that. The units in Manstein's force were wretched, mostly ad hoc Gruppen, groups of varied size, hastily tossed together and named for whichever officer happened to be available to take command. Manstein's order of battle included Group Stahl, Group Stumpfeld, and Group Spang, among many others. Their ranks consisted of rear area supply troops, stragglers, remnants of destroyed formations, and a new breed, Luftwaffe field divisions, made up of Air Force personnel pulled from bases at the rear, given rudimentary infantry training, and hustled to the front to fight on foot. While some of these units bravely defended their positions, too many melted away at their first contact with Soviet tanks." As Cittino put it, Manstein acted like a chess player, bringing his most powerful weapons, the 1st and 4th Panzer Armies, to where they could use their mobility and power to greatest effect. First, though, he had to get Hitler to agree to withdrawing to more defensible positions. He also convinced Hitler to allow bringing new but understrength divisions to the front, and to send the 2nd SS Panzer Corps from France. You history buffs out there know the 2nd SS Panzer Corps achieved a certain level of notoriety on the Eastern Front earlier as part of Army Group North attacking toward Leningrad. But after the setbacks in the winter of 1941-42, it was badly mauled and sent to France. So now, refitted and rebuilt, it was returned to the Eastern Front, this time to the southern sector. By late February, Army Group South had about 120,000 to 130,000 men, compared to the 210,000 Red Army troops and thousands of tanks that they faced. And that's thousands of tanks just in the southern sector, compared to the total of 500 the Germans had all along the Eastern Front from the Baltic Sea to the Black. So on paper, the German position didn't look too good. But that's on paper. Reality is different. When the Red Army's Operations Star and Gallop, which I described last episode, as they advance hundreds of kilometers to the west, almost to the Dnipro River, the Germans now could at least respond. But it was a close thing. On 19th February, the Red Armies were advancing toward Zaporizhia on the Dnipro River at almost its easternmost reach. So if you take a look at any map of Ukraine, you'll see that the Dnipro starts off going northwest to southeast, and it makes a big bend in the middle of the country, and then it starts flowing at almost right angles. And around that easternmost reach are cities like Dnipro and Zaporizhia. It turns out that Zaporizhia, in late February 1943, was where von Manstein had his headquarters. And by coincidence, that very day that the Soviets were advancing, that was the day that Hitler flew in for a face-to-face meeting with von Manstein. At one point, Hitler asked, "Whose tanks are approaching?" Von Manstein had to admit that they were T-34s from the Red Army, an hour away, quote, "without a single formation between us and the enemy," end quote. He bundled Hitler back onto a plane, and the Soviets never knew just how close they were to their supreme enemy. With this penetration westward, the Red Army created a huge salient or bulge in the front lines. They also made the same mistake the Germans had in 1941, and in fact, in this whole operation. Overextended supply lines vulnerable to flanking attack, and also positions that were ahead of where they could bring up more supplies in time. After advancing as much as 500 miles or 800 kilometers in weeks, all the way almost to the Dnipro, the soldiers were exhausted. They were also running low on fuel, and let's not forget that few Soviet tanks at this time had radios, so their communications were hampered. By the end of February, the Soviet operation was over. They had reached what military people call their culmination point, where further movement forward is impossible for the time being. Then, von Manstein launched his operation, slashing through the overextended Soviet lines, entrapping thousands of soldiers, and closing once again on the city of Kharkiv. As described last episode, the panzers of the 1st and 4th Panzer Armies attacked from the south, while the 2nd SS Panzer Corps drove down from the north, trapping thousands of Red Army tank units and tens of thousands of troops. See Map 1 on the webpage for this episode. So, at the beginning of March 1943, von Manstein was ready for the next phase of his winter plan, recapturing Kharkiv. Meanwhile, at the same time, in the northern and central sectors, the Germans were making moves to resolve their own huge salients around Demyansk and Rzhev. But before I get into all that, it's time for our regular feature, What Else is Happening in the War? Europe. 18th February 1943. Vichy France creates the Service de Travail Obligatoire, or Mandatory Work Service, which deports hundreds of thousands of French citizens to work in forced labor in Nazi Germany. This allows the Germans to draft as many as 800,000 German men from so-called non-essential industries and send them to the Eastern Front. 1st March 1943. Hurrying Heinz Guderian becomes Inspector General of Armored Troops for the German Army. He tries to ramp up production of German weapons, tanks, and other armor, but it's impossible. They never could catch up to the USSR's rate of turning out tanks and armor. 12th March. Elas, the Greek People's Liberation Army, liberates the city of Karditsa in Greece. In Africa. 6th March. Battle of Medinine, Tunisia. Rommel and the Afrika Korps' last battle in Africa. The Axis tries a spoiling attack on the Allies to block the British 8th Army's advance, but fails in one day. 16th March, General George Patton leads the tanks of the American 2nd Corps into Gaza, Tunisia. 20th March, the British 8th Army breaks through in Tunisia to the Marath Line. 23rd March, Battle of El Getar, Tunisia, where Patton's 2nd Corps defeats the Afrika Korps under General Hans-Jürgen von Arnim. In the Pacific, 2nd to 5th March, Battle of the Bismarck Sea. Australian and American air forces sink 8 Japanese troop transports near New Guinea. 26th March, Battle of the Komondorsky Islands in the Aleutian Island chain in the northern Pacific. The U.S. Navy intercepts Japanese ships trying to reinforce the island of Kiska. The result is pretty inconclusive, as neither side is well prepared. In China, the U.S. inducts the Flying Tigers, formerly the American Volunteer Group of the Chinese Air Force, into the U.S. Army Air Force, and it becomes the 14th Air Force. Turning to Eastern Europe, 13th March 1943, the Germans liquidate the Jewish ghetto in Krakow, Poland. On 16th March come the first reports of the Katyn massacre, the mass murder of Polish prisoners of war by the Soviet NKVD, reached the West. The Soviets blame the Germans. And that's what's happening elsewhere in the war in February and March 1943. On 5th March 1943, the German 2nd SS Panzer Corps was on the outskirts of Kharkiv, ready to capture it for the second time. Von Manstein ordered the corps to sweep around the city to the north and encircle it. But its commander, General Paul Hauser, defied orders and decided to attack the city straight on. This was not the first time that Hauser had disobeyed orders. Last episode, I told you how, less than a month earlier, the 2nd SS Panzer Corps had been in Kharkiv before its liberation. Their orders, directly from Hitler, had been to stand firm. But Hauser believed that in doing so, Kharkiv could become a second Stalingrad. So, without authorization, he withdrew the corps from the city to a position west of the Meuse River, putting a river between his forces and any enemy attacks. According to blogger Barry C. Jacobson, quote, "Time and again, Waffen-SS commanders defied orders and took what actions they saw necessary. It is telling that Hauser could defy Hitler himself at Kharkov and be spared even a reprimand. In the Red Army, attempt at such action would have been cut short by a commissar's bullet to the head." End quote. So what was the 2nd SS Panzer Corps? Well, it consisted of 3 panzer divisions. The 1st SS Panzer Division Liebstandort SS Adolf Hitler, or LSSAH. The 2nd SS Panzer Division Das Reich, which had some Tiger tanks as well as Panzer IIIs and IVs. And the 3rd SS Panzer Division Totenkopf, or Death's Head. All 3 of these divisions had already served in the Eastern Front and participated in Operation Barbarossa and had achieved a certain reputation. So, for example, the Liebstandort SS, or LSSAH, had started out in 1933 as part of Hitler's personal bodyguard. It grew over the years. By 1939, it was a fully equipped military division, took part in the invasion of Poland. Later, it served in Yugoslavia, in Greece, in France, and committed war crimes in each of these sectors. For Operation Barbarossa, the LSSAH was attached to Army Group South and took part in the fall of Kiev, and then later, Fall Blau, or Operation Blue, the operation in the Caucasus. They took Rostov-on-Don, but after the Battle of Rostov-on-Don, so before the divisions got to Stalingrad, it was so under strength, so worn down by Soviet resistance, it was transferred west to reform and set up in Normandy as part of the occupation. The Das Reich Division had served in Yugoslavia and committed war crimes there. For Operation Barbarossa was attached to Army Group Center toward Moscow. In Operation Typhoon, that final attempt of the German army to take Moscow, the Das Reich Division lost 60% of its men and lost even more in the Soviets' winter counteroffensive. So it too, after that, was sent west to refit. The Totenkopf, Death's Head, had a particular reputation for brutality and war crimes. For Barbarossa, it was part of Army Group North, striving toward Leningrad. The Demyansk Pocket Operation, which is in an earlier episode, I encourage you to take a look at that. It was part of the group of German divisions, of German armies that was almost surrounded in a deep salient around the city of Demyansk. By April 1942, it had lost 80% of its strength. It managed to break out, and it, too, was sent west to France as part of that occupation and to refit and rebuild. As described earlier, von Manstein persuaded Hitler to give him these rebuilt divisions and assembled them into the 2nd SS Panzer Corps under General Paul Hauser. According to Jacobson, for the 2nd SS Panzer Corps, quote, "It was now a matter of pride that they recapture the city they had been forced to abandon just weeks earlier," end quote. So, General Hauser once again defied orders from both von Manstein and Haut, commander of the 4th Panzer Army. Hauser deployed the 1st Liebstandard, the LSSAH, to attack from the north of the city, while the 2nd Das Reich Division attacked from the west. The Death's Head, or Totenkopf Division, formed a protective screen against counterattack from the north and northwest. And you can see this in Map 2 on the webpage for this episode. They moved into the city itself on 11th March, beginning one of the bloodiest phases of the war, fighting street by street and house by house against stubborn Red Army defense. One battle group, a combination of armor and infantry, even captured a Red Army divisional command staff. By 14th March, the Germans had driven the Red Army out of Kharkiv again, and the Wehrmacht's battle flag was flying over the central Dzerzhinsky Square again. This accomplished, Manstein turned his attention northward. The Grossdeutschland Division swept toward the city of Belgorod, only 50 miles or 77 kilometers away from Kharkiv, and captured it on 23rd March. The Third Battle of Kharkiv resulted in 45,219 Red Army troops killed or missing, and another 41,250 wounded. The Germans destroyed 1,140 Soviet tanks and 3,000 guns, at a cost of 4,500 killed or missing Germans and another 7,000 wounded from the SS Panzer Corps. A total of 11,500 casualties, 1/8 of the Red Army's losses. By 26th March, the front in the southern sector had been stabilized. That was in Bestorizhia, or in Russian, Rasputitsa. The muddy season of no roads set in, and no one was going anywhere. Now it's time for a shift of focus north, for a full picture of the war on the Eastern Front. But first, let's take a short break. This is Beyond Barbarossa, the first and so far only English-language podcast that focuses on the Eastern Front of World War II. And by now, you know I'm Scott Burry, writer and narrator. If you like this podcast, why not subscribe or follow, or whatever your preferred podcasting platform calls it? And please consider supporting it at any amount through Patreon. Visit beyondbarbarossa.ca and click on the Patreon link in the banner. Thanks!
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe? by Ukrainian princesses, or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army. Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more about my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel, and all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now let's get back to Scott exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Thanks for coming back. Now that we've described the Third Battle of Kharkiv, which saw the Germans return to occupy Ukraine's second largest city, and the stabilization of the front in the south, for now at least, let's take a look at the northern sectors of the Eastern Front. First, to the very farthest northern sector of the war in the east, Finland. As I described way back in episodes 10 and 11, Finland was a reluctant ally of Germany because the USSR had invaded and captured a lot of their territory during the Winter War of 1939 to 1940, just after the partition of Poland by Nazi Germany and the communist USSR. Then, with the launch of Operation Barbarossa, Finnish units captured large parts of Karelia, that's that immediate border area between Finland and the USSR in the southern half of the country. The Finnish armies came within 32 kilometers or 20 miles of Leningrad from the northwest on the Karelian Isthmus. They also captured the western and northern shores of Lake Ladoga. This blocked the Soviets' ability to bring supplies into the city, or helped block it. Later in 1941, Finnish units participated with the Wehrmacht in the far northern attack toward Murmansk called Operation Arctic Fox, which failed, largely because the Germans just were not prepared for fighting that far north. If you don't remember that, go back to episodes 10 and 11 for a refresher, but only after you finish listening to this episode. After that, the Finns' activity in the war was pretty stagnant. In June 1942, Finnish Commander-in-Chief Carl Gustav Mannerheim refused Hitler's request to invade Leningrad. After that, Finnish operations were largely limited to mine laying in the Gulf of Finland and tying down the Red Army defenders north of Leningrad. The Finnish Ladoga Naval Detachment began operations in August 1942, sinking smaller Soviet boats on the lake and otherwise interdicting supply operations to Leningrad. But it was disbanded in the winter of 1943, so about 6 months. The Finnish government also refused to participate in the Holocaust. Two Finnish officials secretly deported 8 Finnish Jews to Germany, but after that, the Finnish government flat out refused to transfer any more. The Finns did, however, create concentration camps in Karelia. They planned to expel ethnic Russians from territory they controlled. Most ethnic Russians had already evacuated this area, but about 85,000 remained, mostly the elderly, women, and children. Most of the men were drafted into either the army or to work in essential industries. About 30,000 ethnic Russian civilians from the Karelian area were interned in concentration camps in 1941, and some 3,500 died in the harsh winter of 1942 as a result of the conditions. Following year, Finland reversed its policy of discrimination against ethnic Russians, built new Russian language schools, and invited the International Red Cross to inspect the camps. From 1942 to 1944, the Soviets conducted unconventional warfare against Finland, such as forming so-called partisan units, which were really just roving bands of Soviet soldiers, of Red Army soldiers, to carry out sabotage in Finland. The Red Army also attempted a number of times to take Finnish territory along that long north-south border, but these were all repulsed. By 1943, Finnish operations were mostly limited to holding the territory and tying down Red Army units. So that's the far north and the far south of the Eastern Front. But what about the middle? I'm glad you asked. Let's take a look. In 1942, just south of Leningrad, the Red Army's northwestern front had pushed the German 16th Army back around the city of Demyansk. They had come close to encircling the Germans, but the Germans managed to open up a corridor and establish a salient. Repeated attempts by the Soviets failed to break the lines. And this is the place where I mentioned that the Liebstandarte SS division was so badly mauled. So in January 1943, Stavka planned another operation, Operation Polar Star, presumably hoping to repeat the success of Operation Star to the south. They assigned units of the Northwestern Front, the Leningrad Front, and the Volkhov Front, as well as another so-called special group, to destroy the German Army Group North. Georg Zhukov, as usual, coordinated the many large armies. The plan was for the 1st Shock Army to attack the narrowest part of the corridor on 19th February from the south, break through the lines, and link up with the 27th Army coming down from the north. This would completely encircle the Germans. Then other armies would join in and destroy the trapped German forces, before moving farther west to capture Novgorod. However, they delayed this plan because of bad weather, and that special group that was being set up wasn't quite ready. But the Germans naturally anticipated these moves. I mean, it only makes sense. So, on 29th January, Hitler gave permission to Field Marshal Georg von Kukler to withdraw from the pocket. The 16th Army then began fortifying their lines, especially the narrow link between the pocket and the main part of their lines, called the Ramushevo Corridor. They laid as many as 1,500 mines per kilometer, and also built other defenses. The Soviets realized the Germans were getting ready to withdraw, so they moved up the plan again to 15th February and sent the 11th and 53rd Armies, not those two armies originally planned, to cut off the corridor and prevent the Germans from escaping. Then the 34th Army attacked northeast of Demyansk, so at the far end of the pocket. But fierce resistance forced them to break off the attack. Meanwhile, the Germans were withdrawing, starting with those unnecessary supplies and equipment, and then on 17th February, the full withdrawal. Stavka ordered all available forces to attack before the Germans could escape, but they failed, and they had to break off the operation on 28th February, 1943. The Germans' withdrawal was complete by the 1st of March, and the Germans were able that way to shorten their defensive line and consolidate their forces, making them even a more stubborn enemy. A little later, a similar operation started a little to the south. Rzhev. The Red Army's winter counteroffensive, starting in December 1941, pushed the German Army Group Center back from Moscow, resulting in a huge hook-shaped salient or bulge in the line centered on the city of Rzhev, about 200 kilometers west of Moscow. It was held by the powerful German 9th Army. This salient persisted for over a year, despite repeated attempts by the Red Army to eliminate it. One of these attempts was called Operation Mars, which I described in episode 39. The operation involved the Soviet Western Front and the Kalinin Front. 9 full armies plus 8 separate corps, in total over 700,000 personnel and 1,718 tanks. The German 9th Army there comprised about half that number, around 350,000 troops in 15 infantry and paratrooper divisions, 5 panzer divisions, and 3 motorized divisions. They had 1,615 tanks and great air support from the Luftwaffe in 1942. In short, the Red Army had about twice the personnel and roughly equal numbers of tanks for Operation Mars, all planned and coordinated by the Star General of the USSR, Stalin's military right hand, Georgi Zhukov. Operation Mars launched on 25th November 1942, almost a year since the operation that had rescued Moscow. And it was Zhukov's greatest defeat, ending on 20th December, so less than a month, with over 300,000 Soviet casualties, including 100,000 dead, and the destruction of 1,600 tanks, almost every single tank they brought to the operation. In comparison, the Germans suffered 40,000 casualties. The Rzhev salient remained a thorn digging into the USSR's side for another 3 months. So, following their victory at Stalingrad, the Soviet High Command on 6th February 1943 ordered planning for another offensive on the salient. On 18th February, 2 weeks later, and one day after the beginning of the full withdrawal from the Donetsk pocket, Soviet reconnaissance noted that the Germans were preparing to retreat from Rzhev as well. Units were moving west, and bridges, railway lines, and so on were being prepared for demolition. While the Germans had successfully held the Soviets off, maintaining their position in the salient, they had had to commit 21 divisions, 300,000 men, 400 artillery pieces, and 100 tanks. By 1943, that's 20% of their total complement of tanks on the Eastern Front. Drawing back from the salient would shorten their lines, making them easier to defend, and also allow the Germans to deploy those 21 divisions elsewhere, like in the south. Inside the salient, the German 9th Army was indeed getting ready for withdrawal. They built successive defensive lines across the salient to protect their retreat, as you can see on map 3 on the webpage. The commander of the 9th Army, General Walter Model, ordered large-scale security sweeps, claiming they were taking action against so-called bandits. The Germans committed numerous war crimes, killing 3,000 civilians, deporting all males from the area, poisoning wells, and razing villages in a scorched earth campaign. It seems to me that the Germans did more scorched earth and burning down farmhouses than the Russians did. The German withdrawal started in earnest on 1st March 1943 and took 2 weeks, but it was a gradual withdrawal, back to one line after the other. So on March 3rd, the Red Army entered the city of Rzhev without encountering any resistance. By the 12th, they had taken the cities of Olonino, Gzhatsk, Sichovka, Bely, and Vyazma. But their advance was hampered by those successive defensive lines, which included minefields, trenches, and so on. The Red Army did encounter German forces at their final withdrawal line on 22nd March, but they found the Germans well dug in and fighting hard. The Soviet advance stopped exactly where the Germans had planned. By the end of March 1943, the map of the central and southern sections of the Eastern Front looked pretty different from what they had been in the fall of 1942, just 6 months earlier. If you look at maps 4 and 5 on the webpage, you can see that it's not straight, but it looks a lot smoother, a nice smooth curve, except for a big bulge westward between the cities of Orel and Belgorod, centered on the city of Kursk. Now, we've seen before how the Germans responded to bulges in their line. But we'll have to get to that in a future episode. So, join me in 2 weeks to look at further developments and operations on the Eastern Front and elsewhere in the Second World War in the spring of 1943. Thank you for listening to Beyond Barbarossa, the podcast about the Eastern Front of the Second World War. For a better understanding of the events and developments I described, please see the maps and photos on the website for this episode, beyondbarbarossa.ca or beyondbarbarossa.podbean.com, and then just click on the title for this episode. You can also listen to the episode on my own website, writtenword.ca, and click on the podcast button in the banner. I want to take this opportunity to thank all who have supported the podcast through Patreon. Patrons at any level get early access to episodes as well as bonus episodes every couple of months. To become a supporter, all you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and choose the level of support you're comfortable with. If you like this episode, please consider following Beyond Barbarossa on your preferred podcasting app. and I'd really appreciate a rating on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Podbean, or wherever you listen. That really helps spread the word to others who are interested in history and who maybe haven't heard of us yet. Do you have something to add, to clarify, a question to ask? Did you notice I made an error? Uh-oh. Please, reach out, let me know. I love to hear from listeners. You can send an email to contact@beyondbarbarossa.ca or reach me through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. Original music is composed and recorded by Nicholas Burry. I'm Scott Burry. Until next time, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraini!